Hello and welcome to the OnFIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we talk about the ECB ahead of their monetary policy decisions. This is Ellie Groves from London, and today we talk to Lars Feldt, who is Professor for Economic Policy at the University of Freiburg and is Chairman of the German Council of Economic Experts. He is joined by Jeffrey Yu, who is FX and Macro Strategist for EMEA at BNY Mellon Markets. Thank you for joining us today. I first of all want to put into context what we'll be talking about, and I would like to quickly talk about the economic outlook for the euro area and likelihood impacts of an asymmetric recovery. Lars, please do begin.
Well, when you think about the current situation in the European Union, particularly the European Monetary Union, you see that there's going to be a strong, a sharp decline of GDP growth in the course of this year. So actually, it has happened already in the second quarter of this year. We have differentiated performance across the Eurozone, so some countries are more heavily affected than others. But overall, we will look at about -8.5% in the economic growth of the Eurozone. As I say, there is a heterogeneous development. So on the one side, you have countries like Germany, they have less decline in GDP growth, -6.5%, for example. And you have others like Italy, Spain, France, they have two-digit rates between 10 and 11.5% in the minus area. So this is the situation we are facing. At the moment, the forecasts that I now have reported from the end of the second quarter of 2020, they still hold. So the situation has not yet become worse in the sense that the additional infections that we are observing will negatively affect the economy. We do not observe that yet. So I think we still can trust in these forecasts that we had until the summer.
Thank you very much. Jeffrey, do you have anything to add, and also perhaps from a market perspective, on how you see the recovery in Europe?
So two things, really. Firstly, as we've seen last week during the release of the purchasing managers indices, especially on the services sector, we can already see, you know, on a forward-looking basis, that fears of a second wave and renewed lockdowns and even partial lockdowns, you know, that's actually, you know, driving services PMIs much lower compared to the previous month. So this already is a risk to, I would say, not just short-term economic growth, but, you know, Europe's hopes to rebalance their economies, you know, more in favour of the household, in favour of domestic demand. So, you know, that is one risk. Secondly, though, in Asia, you know, we are seeing life almost going back to normal, especially in China. You know, you've seen pictures in Wuhan even of crowds thronging in a water park, you know, much to the concern of, you know, many epidemic control experts. But that, on the other hand, you know, does signal that if emerging markets in Asia, who may be handling the crisis better, if they are actually going to reflate, you know, is that going to start to drive the manufacturing sector as well? Because, you know, that's one area of the Eurozone economy. If you look at the PMIs, if you look at hard data and soft data, the figures have actually been holding slightly better. So are we going to see an uneven recovery as well in between sectors? I think these are the two factors asset allocators are going to be looking at.
And with this in mind, what do you think the ECB policy decision might look like? Obviously, it hasn't happened yet, and the previous one was a sort of a hold rather than a reduction in the interest rates or an expansion of the PEPP, which was already expanded in the month before. Do you think that with this increased risk, and especially in the discrepancy between sectors and countries in the euro area, the ECB will be looking to change or adapt their policy?
I think right now it's a bit too early. And note the last ECB decision was conducted, you know, before the EU summit, you know, where the recovery plan was announced. And so circumstances have changed a bit on that front, but also circumstances have changed, you know, on the domestic side, on the macro side. So you've got to balance, you know, things out. I think it's a bit too early to move them, but there are two crucial factors. Firstly, you know, they would want to actually, you know, look at, you know, where you know, where Europe stands in terms of managing COVID, right? So if there are signs that the second wave has been successfully contained, and we follow comments, you know, by Chancellor Merkel and also President Macron, whereby they both stated there will not be any more national level lockdowns, you know, then they don't need, you know, too strong, you know, of an emergency reaction in the same way that we saw during the first quarter. You know, secondly, one thing I'm looking for is actually the staff economic projections. So Euro has actually, you know, moved quite a bit, you know, since the June round of forecasts, almost 10 big figures. So while it's too early to, you know, worry about exchange rate pass through, I just think at least mathematically, you know, they may need to take down forward-looking inflation forecasts, you know, down a notch. So that actually kind of lays out the path to do more easing if needed. But for now, I think September is a bit too early. You know, perhaps in December, if there is a second wave, or if there isn't, you know, then they can assess as they look forward towards 2021 and 2022.
I also think that we are in a current situation which is quite uncertain, meaning that it might be too early for additional expansionary measures by the ECB. One of the risks that we also face is the situation in the US, which is a quite important market for European producers as well. So as Jeffrey said, China or Japan, Asia overall is performing perhaps better than we thought in the beginning of the summer. But on the other side of the world, in the US, things might look worse. And so we need to try to find out what this future development in the U.S. is. So this is an additional risk for European producers, and the ECB might take this risk also into account. What we currently see regarding price developments is that some measures taken in member states of the Eurozone, for example, the VAT, the temporary VAT reduction in Germany, is also adding to price pressure, reducing the inflation rate somewhat. So I think it is too early for the ECB to react, but maybe the ECB thinks better to do it now than to do it in December. So we might also see a reaction now, even after the decisions by the summit in July.
Thank you. I want to actually touch on that inflation question. So the impact of COVID-19 for oil price wage growth, and will these create different inflation conditions across the monetary union? Wrapped up in that, is there a disconnect between the markets and the real economy? Do we see a different economic environment to one that we have previously known? Perhaps Lars, could you pick up on those points first, and then Geoffrey, I'll come over to you.
So first of all, the GDP reduction is, of course, also putting pressure on the inflation rate. And that's what we already observe, have already observed in the course of this year. And this should be going on for the next couple of months. The question that we have to address is, first of all, what does this mean in the longer term for the reactions to the change situation? On the one hand, we expect that the recovery is only taking up slowly. We have some individual decisions in member states that might put upward pressure on the inflation rate next year. I already mentioned the temporary VAT reduction in Germany, which is meaning in the beginning of next year, it's going to increase. The VAT rate is going to go back to its previous level, which is meaning there's upward price pressure in one of the largest economies in Europe, which will also add towards the overall inflation rate. The question is, to what extent is there a relocation of value added of production from the international markets to European markets? It's one of the discussions we are also having, particular in Germany and France, but also in other countries in Europe. That the internationalized production chains are again well relocated back to the domestic economy. If this is the case, then there can be expected to be price increases as well from that. On the other side, the labor markets don't look like that there is going to be pressure from the wage side. I don't expect that. So this is meaning that we have moderate inflation rate in the first half of the next year as well. And probably the ECB will react to that as well.
Geoffrey, do you have anything to add on the inflation, and perhaps also discussing the euro strength and whether that, how that plays into the inflation outlook?
So you know, looking at an inflation, if we start to decompose in the PPI, for example, and what's going on in the manufacturing sector versus actually what's going on in terms of consumer goods and services, so manufacturing prices actually tend to be a bit more volatile, and it's due to the fact of it being a global market. But we are actually seeing much more resilience on the domestic side, on domestic goods and services. So that actually fits into the rebalancing narrative for the Eurozone, and it's something that I certainly sincerely hope that the recovery plan, given how it can actually foster investment within Europe, we know Europe has an investment gap, hopefully that can continue to accelerate this positive process, notwithstanding an ongoing, whack-a-mole COVID reactions. So overall, I think inflation can actually be put on a more sustainable footing if it's going to be driven by the household side. I know the demographic issues and the longer term potential growth is often a worry, but you need to actually start to generate a virtuous cycle for any hope of the ECB ever getting back to its price target. But otherwise, in terms of euro strength, and this actually ties into what's driving inflation, I think even if euro actually goes stronger from here or maintains its current strength, as long as the domestic price, as long as domestic demand and domestic price pressures are actually sustainable as well, then I think the ECB will actually be okay with it. It's often less about where the euro is. It's more about pace. It's more about speed. If you told the ECB, euro dollar will be at 130 in 12 or 18 months' time, I think they'll be fine with it. If it's there in, say, 6 weeks' time, then they probably won't be fine with it, right? Because that can actually knock its expectations off relatively quickly. But going back to an asset allocation point, I do think, right now the sensitivity or the correlation between how European equities have been performing, especially the export sector, versus euro strength, that may have started to decouple a bit. Again, especially if we have a strong reflation story, there actually isn't, I would say, a conflict between a stronger euro versus inflation, versus margins. So hopefully we can, in 6 to 12 months' time, actually move into that kind of environment, where we can tolerate a stronger euro and reflation and margin expansion at the same time.
Thank you. I want to bring it back to the ECB and looking a little bit longer term on the monetary policy tools that they have at their disposal. What's your opinion on whether the interest rates are at the lower band, or can they be cut further? Or do you think that there will be a path back towards normalization in their monetary policy decisions, slightly more on the medium to longer term? Obviously not their decision next week, but over the course of years. But it will, do you see a path back to normalization and the exit strategy for the BEPP? Lars, please.
As you say, this is somehow a speculative question, because in the short term, it's clear that normalization cannot be achieved. We are in one of the most important economic shocks that we have observed since the Second World War. So much time is needed to get out of this economic slump that we are currently in. We at the Council of Economic Experts in Germany, we expect the German economy to be back on its previous growth path in 2022 at the earliest. So if everything's running well and the rest of the Eurozone is also performing in a similar sense, then we can talk about normalization from 2022 onwards. And again, this is meaning that the ECB, as cautious as it was before, cannot be expected to come up with interest rate increases or selling the bonds that they purchased in their PPP program earlier than 2023. That's what our current expectations are. Of course, it also depends on the development of the inflation rate, what we discussed before. So if there's an earlier increase in the inflation, if there's upward pressure on prices, perhaps the ECB has to react earlier. I think for this medium-term outlook, it's very important what's going to happen in member countries of the Eurozone that have particular structural problems. And Italy and France are the two countries that we have to focus on. Of course, Italy is the most important case. When you look at the performance of the Italian economy, its productivity growth since 1998 is a zero or even a little bit negative. So we only have a very problematic development in Italy since then. And this is the precondition for long-term economic growth to take up. So if Italy does not manage to use the funds from the rescue package of the EU to increase its competitiveness and therefore also reinstall productivity growth, we are going to have further difficulties down the road. And this is the situation we are currently in. So I hope that we will manage on the one side to keep inflationary pressures down, but given all the changes that COVID-19 might impose on the European economies, and on the other side, that the long-term growth in the member countries of the Eurozone is taking up, that we have additional productivity increases, and this helps us to come up with a normalization of ECB monetary policy. What normalization then means is much more difficult to say. So what is the instrument they are going to start with first? At the moment, I would expect that we are going to see interest rate increases first before they're going to sell any of their bonds from the PAPP or PSPP programs. Perhaps the step before would be that PAPP stops, and then the interest rate increases are going to come. But this is much more in the future than we currently can hope for.
Jeffrey, do you see a similar story in your forecast or your thinking for the medium term?
Well, over the medium term, so for example, you know, some of the growth worries that Lars mentioned, I totally concur with them. I do think, though, there are two things which could actually help with the ECB's gradual path towards normalisation. When a central bank normalises, of course, you're worried about sudden tightening in financial conditions. This is one of the issues with forward guidance, for example. You actually tend to store up a lot of volatility towards the exit, so actually that makes the exit a lot more, let's just say, dramatic, especially for markets, and then it needs to be, and that can create its own issues. But if we actually do see a structural shift in Europe's fiscal and monetary framework, whereby you do have greater moves towards fiscal union, where you do start to fill the investment gap, especially towards the south, I do think that can help smooth the path, towards the exit, and where it actually becomes a bit more normalised, right? And then there's this other debate about, whether we can see rates going up first and then balance sheet runoff wait later, or is it the other way around, or can the two happen concurrently? These are academic debates, but again, if growth is strong enough to withstand any challenge, then notwithstanding short-term volatility, there is a path towards an exit, but probably we are talking towards the latter half of the next 5 years rather than the earlier half of the next 5 years. One other thing I wanted to mention was, and you mentioned how low is the lower bound, amid this debate about the negative rates, I personally do think negative rates do work better in current account surplus economies. Having said that, as we know, the Eurozone is much more fragmented, right? So current account surplus in one area does not imply a surplus in another area, and transmission of negative rates in one banking system may differ compared to transmission elsewhere. If you look at what New Zealand's trying to do right now, in a much smaller economy, much smaller economy, so not directly comparable, but they seem to have actually learned the lessons from what the Bank of England did during its experiments, whereby you cannot have negative rates without a properly functioning funding for lending scheme, whereby you can actually borrow from the central bank at close to the benchmark rate, which is what the ECB has already done. So actually the building blocks are in place, as long as they can guarantee banking, the margins are stable, and there's no shift in liquidity preference on the part of the depositor. So in that sense, as long as the two work together, a funding for lending program and a negative rate scheme, you can actually move the lower bound further south to a further negative, in similar vein of what actually Sweden tried to do. But I think for now, most central banks are happy with their tactical policy. The Fed's about to review their strategic policy. I think same for the ECB soon as well. I think they will have a better framework for where the lower bound is, the operational challenges, and also the path towards normalisation.
My final question, so thank you very much for joining us, is exactly wanting to pick up on a point that you just made, Jeffrey, around the relationship between moving towards a fiscal union in Europe and the relationship that that holds for monetary policy in the ECB. And perhaps, Lars, do you feel that there is the Hamiltonian moment from this European Commission Future Generation Fund, and that we are looking towards a fiscal union that can help the ECB in potentially future crises where they don't have to be the first largest respondent to such crisis, or are we looking at a response to COVID, which is very much in an immediacy sense, and that we still will be operating in a monetary union and a fiscal national environment? But Lars, what is your sense of this?
Yesterday and today, we have this discussion in Germany because the finance minister said that the possibility for indebtedness at the EU level will continue in the future. He thinks it's not going to be a temporary measure, and that we are going to have this fiscal capacity with possibilities to issue debt over the longer term. And on the other side, his coalition partner, the Christian Democrats, they are very much in the opposition to that. And I think this somehow, this struggle within Germany somehow reflects the discussions that we are having in the European Monetary Union overall. So several other countries like the Dutch government or the Danish government as well, which is not part of European Monetary Union, but would also need to agree with such a step towards a fiscal capacity at the EU level. Also Austria, they are opposing these measures much, much more strongly, and they think it's only a temporary kind of fiscal capacity. I can only say if we are going to have this fiscal capacity over the longer term, meaning that the EU is moving towards a federation, much, much more strongly towards a federation, we must ensure that decision-making is continuing in the same way as that, meaning that there must be somehow a control possibility of the EU level regarding fiscal policies at the national level. The control possibilities must be expanded then, meaning that there is some extent of competencies that moves from the member states to the EU level if the EU should have a stronger fiscal capacity in the future. Otherwise, incentives will be unfavorable. Then there are going to be national decisions. For example, the money is spent in public consumption and public transfers, then it is in public investment, and the others at the EU level in particular, they are going to finance that. And this is a kind of asymmetric structure that must lead to moral hazard, and we should avoid that.
Jeffrey, do you have anything to add on the relationship between fiscal and monetary policy within the euro area?
You know, we're often very excited at Bank of New York Mellon, you know, when Hamiltonian moments are mentioned, and the music starts playing in my head as well. But net, you know, right now, we actually, you know, do see a material shift, you know, how the market, you know, views, I would say, Europe's, you know, fiscal framework in, up ahead. I know these are early days, and the lawmakers have, you know, gone to great lengths to explain that this is a one-off. So the mutualization with respect, you know, to the NGE plan, to the recovery plan, is a one-off, and you know there are many, many steps to go before we actually, you know, to, you know, get towards fiscal union. And if Europe wants to go in that direction at all, you know, treaty change probably is inevitable. You know, other institutional matters and need to be addressed as well. But for the ECB, if they know the direction of travel is towards, I keep on going back to that, filling the investment gap, you know, if fiscal policy can actually start to fill the investment gap, then it will basically, you know, take a lot of the burden, you know, off the ECB, and they can actually move towards a bit more of a conventional policymaking framework, right? So hopefully that's going to be incorporated into their strategic review. But I think even if there is going to be change, a lot of it is going to be backloaded. So the importance of the ECB is to set the framework right now to what they can do, so how policy will change if fiscal union is, let's just say, closer on the horizon. But for the time being, I don't think it's going to make too much of a difference. You know, beyond markets are going to be a bit less underweight euro. And, you know, that just by virtue of, you know, more inflows into European asset markets, especially equities, that helps ease financial conditions. And now the challenge is for European governments and corporates to take advantage of it.
Thank you very much. I would like to come to either of you for any final words on this quite wide-ranging discussion that looked at the economic outlook for the euro area and then the discussions on the inflation outlook and structural challenges. I think, Lars, you made a very interesting and good point around the Italian structural shifts that need to be for a sustainable debt management for their COVID response. Ben, we also look at the euro strength and the implications for the inflation outlook from you, Jeffrey, as well, and also what the markets are thinking. And both have talked around the longer term normalization strategies and pathways and a story that could get to in 2023 moves towards normalization and how that links with the fiscal framework from the European Commission as well. And whether we can see that playing out, I think, really depends on what we spoke at the beginning, which is what happens now for COVID, if we've got second lockdowns, if we've got a vaccine coming. And actually, I think that what we say now might change drastically in within a month or two or 6 months. So I think that it is important that we're having these short-term, medium-term, long-term discussions and thought processes and pathways towards this normalization. But I think a lot of it does depend, if I'm correct in saying, on COVID and also on the supply chains and pathways and geopolitical differences as well, and perhaps on the US election, which we will be doing more podcasts on. So if you have any final words, please do let me know. Lars, would you agree with my summary or think that I've missed anything key out?
No, you have not missed anything. In particular, mentioning the presidential elections in the U.S. is quite important. This might change quite a lot. In any case, whatever happens there, I think it is also very much affecting the performance of the U.S. In the next year.
Thank you. Jeffrey, any final words from you?
So one thing I would mention is to the point about asset allocation. So Europe has been probably the most relative to the size of the economy and asset markets, the most unloved region for asset allocators over the last few years. This really is beginning to change. There really is a big underweight or close to zero weight, I would say, ready to be filled. Investors are being overweight dollars, overweight US stocks, especially US tech. But now I think there is a genuine demand for alternatives, genuine demand for, let's say, an alternative reserve currencies, genuine demand for a more diverse asset allocation strategies and also more diverse industry, region, currency exposure. So Europe is very, very, so the Eurozone is very, very well placed actually to tick that box. Renminbi and other areas, China, they are, I would say, in the running as well. But again, the opening is there. The question is, can Europe actually take advantage?
Thank you very much. And thank you both for joining us. And thank you for all for listening. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to our channel. We're on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you so much.